in Al-Anon who's given me so much. She's given me my program and my life added significance. When I think about Mary Fran, I want to share her with everybody, for she epitomizes a wealth of experience, a wonderful sense of humor, and an acceptance and tolerance for people in situations which I would like to emulate. Mary Fran is from Pine, Arizona, and her service work has given her many opportunities to shape and participate in the affairs of our fellowship. I am excited when I think of all of her experiences. Just to name a couple, she was delegate for Arizona. She served on the National Executive Committee for Al-Anon. She served for 5 years as chairman of the Board of Trustees. This is the fourth time she has visited us here in Sacramento. Let us give a warm welcome to Mary Fran of Pine, Arizona.
Thank you very much, Artha. You are a very special person in my life, too. My name is Mary Fran, and I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon, and my home group is the New Hope Al-Anon Family Group in Payson, Arizona. I don't want to immediately correct you, but I was not chairman of the board for 5 years. But anyway, that's very nice of you to give me that added distinction. I was the chairman of the board, but not for that long. Okay. I'm very thrilled to be here. Is this microphone high enough for me? How's that? Okay. I'm very thrilled to be in Northern California again. I have been privileged to be invited here on other occasions, and it's always a wonderful, delightful experience. I know many of you, we go way back in our Al-Anon service. I met many of you at various recovery parts of our program, and others I'm just getting to know, and I'm having a delightful time. So I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm always grateful for the opportunity to come and tell you what happened to me, because that's really what we're doing here. You're going to hear things about me you really didn't care if whether you heard or not, but that goes with it, so... You can sift out what you wish you hadn't heard, and maybe I have some small message, and I hope there is a small message in what I have to share with you. When I first came to Al-Anon, I wanted everybody to know how I had been used and abused, and I wanted to tell you all the terrible things that Tom had done to me. By the way, Tom is my husband. Tom is not only my first husband, he's also my second husband, and so we have a lot of experience there. And Tom, I just want to tell you a couple things about him, because every once in a while somebody says, oh, well, are you married? Do you have a husband? And I do like to drop that in, because it is part of my story and has a lot to do with what happened to me. And so I'll just give you a couple of quick things about him, and then I'm going to tell you mostly about me. Somebody said, I hope you're not going to give us all that stuff before you got to Al-Anon. I said, well, unfortunately, that's part of my story, and I'm going to have to give you some of that stuff, and that requires me going back. But... As I say, Tom and I have been married twice, and I would like to tell you that in August he will celebrate his 23rd year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous in August, so we're very happy about that. Now, Tom is probably the kindest, gentlest, most understanding, compassionate, gentle, and wonderfully self-centered man I have ever known. And with that, I'll move on to tell you about me. I was the third child, the third girl to be born into a family, and I had two older sisters who were frequently held up to me as examples for me to follow. And they're 6 and 8 years older than I am. And the older one was always known as the intelligent, efficient one. And the other one was always called the beautiful and interesting person, that she had this wonderful personality. And then there was me. Now, nobody ever told me that I was not intelligent and efficient, that I was not beautiful, or that I didn't have a personality. But by the time I came along, they didn't bother to tell me that I was either. And so I have an odyssey in my life of trying to find some way where I could feel valuable. And that's really the story of my life, trying to find somewhere where I could feel like I could excel. And many of you may have that same idea in your life. And many of us develop a feeling that we are not equal to other people, or in many cases are inferior. But I certainly developed that along the way somewhere. And I'm sure I took that part into my marriage and into my adult life. But I did go along relatively well as a child, and my mother indulged me in that she gave me an opportunity to have every kind of a lesson known to man. I think she was tired by that time and thought, oh, well, let her do what she wants. And I had different ideas every day about I wanted to join this, or I wanted to be that, or I wanted to take lessons in this and that. And I took all kinds of lessons, always with the idea that there must be some place where I could feel, where I could excel. And I took swimming lessons and diving lessons and lifeguard lessons and skiing lessons and ice skating lessons and ceramic lessons and mosaic lessons, embroidery lessons, sewing lessons, every kind of a lesson you can think of. And I always came home and they said, well, what now? Well, what do you want to do now? Piano lessons, singing lessons. And it just went on. And, of course, I never stayed with anything. I would run down, buy a whole lot of yarn and do three rows and thought, well, that was enough of that. And I never finished anything, and I always had that hanging over my head that why didn't I ever complete anything? I was jumping from thing to thing all my life. And I didn't like details, and those things were details. So anyway, that gives you some kind of an idea about what kind of a kook you got standing up here. Because when later on somebody said to me one day in an Al-Anon meeting, I was never an overachiever like you are. And I said, overachiever? I never achieved anything. I ran from thing to thing to thing. And they said, well, what do you think an overachiever is? And I said, oh, I didn't know that. And then when they would talk about being a perfectionist, they'd say, well, you know, perfectionism is really a problem for some people. I said, never had that problem. I never could do anything perfectly. I tried to do everything perfectly. It drove me absolutely crazy. But I couldn't, and I just kept trying and striving and trying to be excellent and trying to surpass everybody else. They said, what do you think a perfectionist is? So I found out a lot of things about myself in Al-Anon, and it's been quite an odyssey. But anyway, I want to go back now and tell you that as my childhood developed, everything went along quite well, and I took all these crazy lessons and trying to do things. And then I had a very traumatic thing happen. At 16, my father died of alcoholism. Now, this was a terrible, terrible blow to me. I adored my father. I adored him from a distance. And if I have any real, real memories of him, it's that I've really felt neglected. I wanted to be close to him, but he preferred to go to the Elks Club every night after dinner and play cards, and I'm sure he drank. And that was his life. We would sit down and have a family dinner, and then he would leave immediately. And so I grew up yearning to have a father that cared for me. And I'm sure he did care for me, but he just didn't have the time. And as I say, I was a third child, and by that time, you know, the novelty had worn off as children. And so I just kind of did what I wanted to do, which was jump from thing to thing to thing, always trying to look for excellence. So I went away to school, and I went to the University of Colorado. And I came home from there, and I was at a friend's house, and she said, they've just called and asked me to come down and serve the troop trains. Now, I came from a town in Idaho, and they had a famous depot there in that all the troop trains going to the northwest in World War II passed through our town, and we had quite a famous little depot there and a USO hut. So they would stop the trains there, and then the local people would serve coffee and drinks and so forth to the troops. So she said, why don't you come down with me? And I said, oh, okay. So, of course, I went down, and when we had served the train that went on through, we were cleaning up, and in walked three young airmen from the local airbase. She knew them, by the way, and they were in there probably looking for a free cup of coffee. And so she greeted them and introduced me to them, and we ended up going over to my house to play bridge. And, of course, you knew who one of them was. Now, I wasn't terribly impressed with Tom. I mean, he was all right, but I thought, well, they're just looking for a place to go and play cards. So we went over to my house and played cards, and naturally only four people can play bridge. And my sister, the pretty, clever one, who was there, her husband was overseas, and she was about 8 months pregnant, sat down and played bridge with them. And they just thought she was more fun, and I was furious. I thought, well, I brought these fellows over here, and they prefer my sister to me. And I didn't think much of that. But anyway, eventually Tom sidled over to me and invited me out. So anyway, then we started going out. But I was a little hurt, and I really wanted him over there to carry my trunk to the basement. Even in those days, I was a conniving, manipulative person, and I thought, they can come over and carry my trunk down. So that was our first meeting, and we had an introduction from this friend, but anyway. The war was on, and Tom, of course, wanted to get engaged, and I said, fine, however, I'm not going to get married while the war is on, and so I joined the Navy. And he was in the Air Force, so anyway. After the war, which, by the way, was practically over as soon as I got into the Navy, I took care of that. I got the war over. But then we were married. I was only in the Navy not quite a year. And a lot of people say, I could tell you were in the Navy. I said, really? Oh, yeah. Hardly was there. Hardly got my uniform on, and it was over. But anyway. So that was the beginning, and we had a large church wedding in my hometown. And I've got to tell you a little bit about my hometown. I wanted to be something. I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to excel, and I decided I'd be a movie star. Now, I resent some of you people chuckling about that. I was very serious about this, and I was telling that to somebody. They said, well, what did you do to help your cause? I said, listen, I had heard Lana Turner had been discovered in a drugstore, and I spent a lot of time hanging out in the drugstore. But there's not a lot going on in a drugstore in Pocatello, Idaho. Are you awake, Blanche? Okay. Blanche asked me to try to keep her awake, so I'm working on it. I'm going to ask her to critique my talk here. Okay. Well, anyway, I was never discovered yet. And we never know what's around the next corner. I met a fellow here from Southern California, and he was a movie producer. I said, say, where were you when I was trying to get in the movies? But anyway, I didn't get discovered. And so I ended up getting married instead. And I thought, well, this is a very nice-looking man, and we had a lot in common. And I thought he had a lot of possibilities that I could help him with. And I was going to be a good wife, and I was going to help him succeed, and we were going to walk down life's path together and be very happy. So when we were married in my hometown, I had a nice big church wedding. And after the wedding, we had a reception in the local hotel. And people were going through the line and congratulating me, or giving me their good wishes. And finally somebody said, well, what happened to the groom? Oh, well, I don't know. We looked around and couldn't find him. They went upstairs and found him in the lobby. We were down the mezzanine floor. And they said, well, Tom, what are you doing up here? Oh, well, nobody told me where to go. And I thought, well, I'll take care of that. And I have been ever since. Found him where to go. But he is a charming man. And the very best thing about him is he puts up with me. And I have had a fascinating life of traveling and going around in service. And he does not have a jealous, possessive bone in his body and has always said, you don't think I would ever try to stop you from doing what you think you enjoy this much. And I would never interfere with the pleasure you get out of your service work. So I must tell you that he's genuinely a charming man. But we had our moments. And after we had been married about 9 years, he came home one day, and he said, I've decided to go on the road. And I said, well, what does that mean? Well, that means that I won't be here anymore in the weekdays, and I'll only be coming home on weekends. And so you and the children will just have to get along, and I'm sure you'll find some things to do, and I'll be home every weekend, and we'll keep in contact. And this is going to be a wonderful opportunity in that it's going to further my career, and it's going to be a wonderful thing for us eventually. It's going to mean more remuneration, and it certainly is something that I think I can do and do very well. Well, as it turned out, he did it very well. Tom became a professional salesman, and if you're interested, or whether you're not, I'm going to tell you that he helped pioneer the frozen French fry potato all over the United States. And that seems like kind of a strange thing to do, but years gone by, people peeled and fried all their own French fry potatoes, and he started with two other men to canvass the country to develop the idea that every hamburger joint and every restaurant and every hotel could further their own kitchen facilities by buying frozen French fries. So he helped pioneer that, and he was fabulously successful. He had a natural bent for sales and still has this boyish naivety about him that he's very charming. And I think a lot of times people would just buy things from him just because he was this very nice kind of naive man with boyish charm. And, of course, that's what I loved about him the most. So he was very, very successful. However, with that, he kept driving himself, and as often is the case, he began to drink. And he would be exhausted on the road, and I'm sure a drink or two helped him be lifted up and be able to get up the next morning. Now, I started noticing behavioral changes. We moved all over the country. We were transferred here and there and everywhere, and he had fabulous opportunities for promotion, and they followed. And it meant moving, and we frequently did. The children seemed to benefit by it. In fact, they would make friends. As the moving van would run, pull up to the front door, they would have neighbor children running up and down the ramp of the moving van, and they would have new friends just that quickly. And they didn't seem to suffer by it. They're, to this day, all well-rounded and outgoing, and it didn't ever seem to bother them. But I got a little tired of it, and it was difficult for me to constantly be uprooted and moving on. But I kept thinking in the back of my mind, yeah, this is what Tom does well, and we will all benefit by it someday. So we continued to do it. We moved many, many times. At one time, I quit counting after 75 times. Sometimes in the very beginning, of course, it was picking up the suitcases and moving on down the street to another apartment and so forth. But as time went on, we accumulated more things and more children and more responsibilities, and it got more complicated later. But I did try to make a life of what was going on, and in my odyssey to be a person that was achieving something, I became the PTA president. I wrote the Christmas pageant at the church we attended. I was the Sunday school director. I was the choir director. I did a lot of solo work, and I did try to make a life of my own, but I began to be very lonely. And Tom was gone, and now he didn't seem to know how old the children were. He didn't seem to be very interested in my activities. And as I say, I was a long ways away from my own family, and I began to think maybe I'm not as attractive as I used to be. Maybe his work is now more important. And then I began to, one day I noticed in his briefcase, here was a whiskey bottle. Now, this was a shock to me. I thought he was totally devoted to his work. And when I found this whiskey bottle, I presented it with gusto, and I said, "And what is this?" "Oh, honey, you know how it is. You know, we gather around in the evening, and we've done a lot of big sales calls, and we've sold carloads of potatoes, and some of the fellows, and we gather around in the evening, and we have a drink, and sometimes that's where the big deals are done. You know, we sit around, and we consummate these big deals," and I say, "Oh, uh-huh." But I began to now start checking the briefcase, and it seemed to me there was a briefcase there every week. And he'd say, "Oh, somebody, you know, we just had a little drink to celebrate a big contract we wrote," or that's where we were just sitting consummating a big, big new idea, and I imagine somebody just stuck that in my briefcase. Oh, uh-huh. So I began to just kind of put it in the back of my mind and think, well, I guess that's what it means when you get into the big business world and you do have a drink. And I don't suppose there's anything wrong with it. Once in a while, I would be required to put on cocktail parties for the business folk that would be in our home, or we'd have people staying with us. And I was expected to be the hostess and provide the food and the drinks, and they were all hard-drinking people, and I thought, this is a way of life. And once in a while, Tom would say to me, "Why don't you have a drink? Loosen up. Get with it. You know, just because your father had some kind of a problem. Sometimes I think you're developing a problem," and I think, I wonder if he's right about that. Maybe I do have a thing about drinking. And I didn't seem to enjoy it, and I didn't like the taste of it. And I know now today I didn't like it because I didn't have control. And that's a good word. But anyway, as life went on, the days went on, and the years rolled by, we became very distant. Now, by this time we had moved to Toronto, and Tom came home one day, and he said, "There's something terribly wrong with me." I said, "Oh, well, you got that right." Well, he was hemorrhaging, and he had a very serious problem, and we didn't know what it meant. And he entered the Toronto General Hospital, and they said, "Well, we're going to have to keep him in the hospital about 6 weeks to run a culture on him. He probably has something very serious wrong, and it may be bladder tumors, or it could be cancer of the kidney, or it could be several other things." I thought, good grief, that doesn't sound very good. He sounds like he really has something serious. So after they worked on him and grew this culture and finally determined, he had tuberculosis. Now, this was another big shock to me. We had all been x-rayed, all the children and I, going into Canada. to go into Canada and live, you are classified as landed immigrants, and you must pass all these tests. And we had all had chest x-rays, hadn't been anything show up. So when they told me that he had renal tuberculosis, and for those of you who don't know, that's the kidney. It originates in the lung and passes into various parts of the body and could be bone or in the kidney or whatever. So he apparently had renal tuberculosis for a good many years. It probably had in the service before I ever met him. So they said, well, he has to enter the TB sanitarium. Now, I thought TB was a dead disease, so I was very surprised by this. But now I'm going into full-grown martyrdom, and, oh, my God, this is happening to me, and here I am in a foreign country with three small children and my husband going into a TB sanitarium. So I begin to really kind of feel sorry for myself about this time, and they took him out to the TB sanitarium, and they checked him in, and they said, now, do you want a private or a room in a ward? And I thought, he bore watching. He was becoming very bizarre, and I thought somebody ought to be keeping an eye on him. And I said, I think he ought to be in a ward. Well, now, his mother intervened and thought, well, what kind of a thing was that? His wife wanted to put him in a ward, and she thought he ought to be in a private room. Well, she prevailed, and he was in a private room. But anyway, I now went out to that TB sanitarium every day. Now, I went because I wanted to see what was going on. I mean, I don't want you to think I was that darling a person, but they used to say to me, Mrs. Walker, you don't have to come out here every day. I said, oh, yes, I do. I have to bring him artichokes and olive oil. I have to bring him money for his occupational therapy. I have to rub his back, and I also like to see what he's doing out here. Now, I had one child at home in bed with rheumatic fever. I had another one in the hospital with having a tonsillectomy. He had a lot of infections, bronchial infections and so forth. And I left the older girl with those younger two while I drove the 75 miles each day to the TB sanitarium because I wanted to see what he was doing. And I'm going to check it out. And furthermore, wasn't that my job to keep him there? I mean, the law said he had to stay there, and he wasn't very crazy about it. And I thought, I have got to go out there every day to be sure he stays in that TB sanitarium. So I was very involved with all of that and leaving those three children alone at home every day. And believe me, I've had to make amends for that. I've regretted that very sincerely all these years that I left those children alone. However, they managed okay, but it could have been pretty serious. Well, after Tom had been there about a year, the doctor called me up one day and said, we don't understand, there's a terrible problem out here with Tom. I said, oh, really? Well, yes, he's creating all kinds of pandemonium in this sanitarium. Now, there is horse betting going on. There's practically rioting in the whole wing where he is. And I said, doctor, the man is an alcoholic and he's drinking in your hospital. Now, I didn't believe it was possible for Tom to be able to drink in a TB sanitarium. Because I thought that's probably a good place for him because between the doctor and me and all those nurses were watching him. But anyway, you know, this is an object lesson in no matter how hard we try and how difficult the situation, we cannot outwit somebody who wants to drink. And so this was a good lesson, and I like to pass this on to people because we have the idea that we can stop a person. And if the situation is even more in our favor, they can't drink. Well, he did. One day I had gone out there, and as I say, he was in a private room and had a private bath, and I went in his bathroom, and between the stack of towels, what did I find but a whiskey bottle? And, of course, I went around the corner with it, and I said, okay, what's this? In my usual clever way. He said, oh, honey, you know how it is. Now, there's a nice man down the hall who likes to have a little nip, and he's got this wife who doesn't understand why he'd want to have a little drink. So he asked me, could he leave his bottle in my bathroom? And, of course, I said, well, yes. And then I would say, oh, okay, I see. But you see, here's the denial, full-blown denial. I did not want to admit the man had a drinking problem. How would that make me look? How would that reflect back on me? How would that make me look like I wasn't the foxy lady that I wanted to be? Or that I had been so stupid as to hook myself up with somebody with this terrible problem? So I kept looking the other way, but it was always in the back of my head. So when the doctor called and said, we have this terrible problem, I knew what the problem was. Well, when I told the doctor that the man was an alcoholic, that's the first time I had ever said it aloud. I had never admitted it to me, to God, or another human being. He was shocked. I'm always amazed at some of the medical people who just have something like this, and they're just amazed. They don't know what to do about it. Anyway, they reported to me that they went immediately upstairs, turned Tom's mattress back, and found 27 empty whiskey bottles under his mattress. Now, I thought the man needed watching, and he did, and they weren't doing it. Well, they had him out of that TB sanitarium in 24 hours. They had a tiger by the tail and didn't know what to do about it. Well, he was shortly to be discharged anyway, and they couldn't get rid of him fast enough. But I said to the doctor, okay, now you're turning him loose on me again. What am I going to do with him? So he sent me to a outpatient clinic in Toronto to a gentleman who was supposed to be the foremost expert on alcoholism on the North American continent. And he said, I think this man can help you. I said, oh, good. I need somebody to help us. So I took Tom in tow, and we went charging over there to this clinic. Now, the man looked at Tom, and after a few words from me, he said, now what we're going to do with Tom is we're going to regress him back to his childhood with LSD. And we're going to find out back to his childhood why he drank. And I said to the doctor, I don't think Tom drank as a child. I have always had some smart comeback, no matter what. But anyway. Anyway, I thought, well, if this works, it's great. Whatever it takes, it's great. And so on the appointed day, I took him in tow and took his little elbow in. We marched in there to have his LSD. Now, it was clinically legal in Canada at that time to prescribe LSD. So I stood out in the hall, sort of with my ear to the door, so I wouldn't miss anything. And I heard him say, now, Tom, we're going to inject this. I think I don't know how administered it. I thought they injected it into his arm with a needle. I don't know what they did. But anyway, he had an absolutely horrendous reaction. He was screaming violently. Now, I don't know if the drug did that or his memory did that or what, but he had such a violent, terrible reaction that I'm clinging to the door out there, clutching the side of the wall while he's screaming bloody murder with this reaction. And I heard the doctor say, oh, my God, get him a shot of something or other to counteract this, and they gave him another shot to bring him out of it. Now, that was his big episode with LSD. For a long time, we'd be sitting in the kitchen, and he had flashbacks. And we'd be sitting there, and he'd say, hey, what was that just flew over? Did you see that purple thing over there? Do you hear music? I mean, he had wild and crazy reactions from this. So just with one dose of LSD, he had flashbacks for months. So I wouldn't suggest anybody go that route. It doesn't work. But I must tell you the one wonderful thing that came out of this experience. This doctor also had AA meetings on his premises. Now, this was our first introduction to an AA meeting. And he did suggest we go, and we did. Now, I was just so impressed. I thought this was probably the most beautiful thing I had ever heard. I loved the sharings. I could not believe that a person would stand up there and totally divest themselves of every bit of their essence and tell me and everybody in that audience what they had done, what they wanted to hope for to do in the future. They would strip themselves right down to the bone, and I thought, this is the most amazing thing I have ever heard. I heard those steps read, and I thought, oh, that is a wonderful, wonderful way to live. I was so impressed by what I heard in those open AA meetings. I was thrilled. Tom kind of sat there and looked at the floor, looked at the ceiling, and couldn't get out of there fast enough. And I loved those meetings. I was so absorbed, I just was thrilled. And I thought, if a person could live that way, it would be the answer to everything. If every person I knew could adopt that kind of a way of life, what a wonderful world this would be. And I was terribly enthralled with it. But the message of AA eluded him. I can tell you that I probably reminded him of the things I heard going home, or I poked him when I heard something that I thought was particularly effective. He wasn't interested. And I couldn't believe that he didn't hear it the way I heard it. But anyway, he didn't. And we know how those things happen. Now I'm going to skip ahead and move forward about 10 years, because now Tom was in and out of alcoholism treatment hospitals. And he would go to AA for a while after each one and gradually drop out. And, of course, the drinking would resume, and we all know what that means. The children were growing up now, and they were becoming rebellious and hateful. And I was so mistrustful and thought he had deceived me time and time again. And the children kept saying, Mother, he's not ever going to be any better. He's not ever going to be different. And I'd say, oh, no, this time I think it's going to be different. And I always had that glimmer of hope that one of these times it would catch him and we would move forward and his life would change and all our lives would be affected positively. But it kept going on and kept going on. And then one day I looked at our situation, and now we were terribly, terribly in debt. All our money was gone. We did have a house that we had practically no money into. And he had lost now one job after another. And although he had a fabulous reputation in the food industry, people knew about him now. And he was famous for thinking, well, Tom Walker is a fabulous salesman, but he drinks too much. So the word was out. And now if he got a job at all, it was going downhill lesser and lesser. And finally, he couldn't even get a job. So I came to one day and said, if I'm going to save this family, I'm going to have to go to work. Now, I was not prepared to do that. And I believe that this is probably one of the bigger mistakes I made. I made many as the years went by. But I determined now that if anybody was going to save this family, I had to do it. So I got out the typewriter, brushed up on my typing. I took some shorthand classes, and I started out into the business world. I wasn't prepared, and I started out in a small way in a one-girl office. And then I moved up, and I became a supervisor in a larger office. And then later I became a buyer for a garment company in Kansas City. And I eventually kept increasing my own possibilities of further enhancing my career. And we still weren't getting anywhere, so now I determined I would also become a real estate agent. And so I went to school to learn to sell real estate, and I did that also. So I had two full-time jobs, and I had lost weight. I was looking terrible. I had no life now but just drop in a chair at night and go home and find Tom drunk, and the children now rebellious and hateful and starting to suffer in school, and, of course, all those things that come down on us. And wonder, my God, how has this happened? How could this have happened? So finally, it got to the point where I couldn't even keep up. Or if I did sell a house, I would come home, and I'd shake the check in his face, and I'd taunt him with it, and I'd tell him that at least I was working, and we had some terrible, terrible fights and terrible recrimination. And this was what was going on in our life now. I didn't tell my family for years what happened. I hid this from everybody. I had no friends, no neighbors. And all I did was go to work at these two jobs and keep trying to go forward. Eventually, I decided, okay, somebody said, if you want to really shake him up, file for divorce. I thought, that's what he needs, a shock. I had a laugh at one of the people sharing. They were going to shock somebody. So I decided, all right, that's what I would do. I would shock him into realizing what he was doing, because we had had fights for years about his drinking, and he always refused to admit he even drank. And we would have bottle hunts, and we'd find a bushel basket full of empty bottles around the house, and then we would present it to him, the children and I, and they'd say, okay, what about this? Oh, you just went out in the alley and picked up whiskey bottles. And I had this feeling, if I could just once prove to him that he drank, then we wouldn't have these problems. Now, I mean, how ridiculous. He knew he drank. Why did I have to prove it? But I had this idea that if I could just prove it to him. So I spent days and days and days trying to figure out how to outwit him, how to stay ahead of him, how to hide the checkbook, how to hide the things in the house, put them below in the house so that he couldn't sell them to buy whiskey, and then I'd go down there months later and they'd all be mildewed and rotted. And whatever I did, I was two or three episodes behind him always, and I couldn't keep up. So when I had this idea about divorce, I thought, that's what I'll do. So I filed for divorce, and I told him, I said, I can't stand this anymore. I can't live this way. You've got to get out of our lives. You're destroying all of us. We have nothing left. I'm totally exhausted. I can't keep up with the bills. And he begged me not to do it. He pleaded with me not to do it. And he was so adorable. And so I called it off. Until I'd come home about 2 days later from work, absolutely exhausted again, come around the corner unexpectedly and catch him standing there drinking out of a whiskey bottle again. And then I'd just fly into these uncontrollable rages and say, you've got to get out of here. You're doing it again. You've lied to me, and I can't tolerate it. I can't live with it again. And I'd file again, and I'd say, and the lawyer says, you've got 24 hours to get out of here. And he begged me not to do it. He needed me. He did need me. And so I'd call it off. The third time when I did this, the lawyer finally said to me, are you going to do this or not? Every time I file, it would cost me $75. And I finally said, I guess I'm going to have to go through with it because you got my last $75. So that's how I ended up divorcing him. I really didn't want a divorce. I was only doing it to force a solution, and we all know about that. So anyway, I threw him. I had him thrown out. They came and served him with papers, and when I came home from work that night, he was gone. They had given him 1 hour to get his things out of the house. And I came home and frantically called him all over town. And if I'd have found him, I'm sure I would have told him to come back. But he had gone to his mother's by now, Pennsylvania. So that's how we were divorced. Well, we were divorced for 3 years. And now my situation, and I heard somebody sharing on this, I had nobody to blame now. Tom was out of the house, out of my life. Of course, I had all the problems that were remaining. I had no money, and I was exhausted, and had three rebellious children, and a lot of problems. The banks were calling me up and wanting to know why I wasn't sending payments on this and payments on that. I finally said, my husband has left me. He's a drunk, and I have no money. Oh, well, then they quit bugging me finally. The IRS called up and wanted to know how come this and that about our income tax. And at one point I said, well, you're going to have to talk to my husband. He's in the nut house. And they left me alone about that, and he was. I had put him in the state mental hospital at one point. So anyway... we used to laugh around the house. The children and I developed this weird sense of humor, and my son said, well, Mother, you should have told him that you'd pay it up as soon as you would get Dad to put the knife down he was chasing us around the house with or something. So, I mean, we used the defensive methods of laughing, and my son and I today have a wonderful sense of humor. It's practically the same. But we developed it over the years. But anyway, you learn to cope with what you have. Well, I finally decided I was going to leave Kansas City. I couldn't keep up, and I was fed up, and I wanted to be near someone who cared about me. So my mother lived in Phoenix, and my oldest sister, the intelligent, efficient one, lived in Phoenix, and her husband, and so when they said, why don't you move down here, I sold out the few pitiful things I had and moved to Phoenix, and I had one small, the younger daughter with me now. The older girl was married, and our son was trying to go to the University of Kansas. So I moved to Phoenix. And when I got down there, here was a letter waiting for me at my sister's, and it was from Tom. And I know now what it was. Of course, it was an amends letter, and in it, of course, I didn't know what it was then, but in the letter he said, I can't imagine us not spending the rest of our lives together, and I hope someday we can get back together. And I am now in another alcoholism treatment center in Minneapolis at the Johnson Institute. I thought, oh, that's all I ever wanted. He was in an institution now where he was going to get help. Now, he'd been, I don't know how many before, but this one, I thought, well, he really means it this time. So I jumped on a plane, tore up to Minneapolis, and we were remarried. I mean, what else? All I wanted was an indication that his life was going to be different. Now, all this time, no one ever said to me, there's help for you. There's a place you could go. You might have some problems. Can we help you with anything? All those different places he went, they always said, now, Mrs. Walker, what you need to do for your husband is, and I got so sick of that, and I got so defensive, and I got so to the place where I wouldn't tell him anything, and I'd go in there, and I'd have this tight-lipped look, and they'd say, now, what are you going to do if your husband drinks again? I said, I don't know, but I hope you people stop him. But they never, ever even gave me an idea there was any help for me, or that I even needed any help. And when I think back on that now, I try to remember that and hope these treatment hospitals do work with the families. It's so important. Anyway, we were remarried and moved down to Phoenix. Now my mother was ready to disinherit me. She was horrified. The children were just almost hysterical. Why did you get yourself back into this situation? I said, because it was meant to be. Now, Tom and I had $11 in change between us. It was meant to be, all right. Well, we decided that he could get a job, and he always got a job. He was this affable, lovely, boyish, darling person that people just loved. And he got a job right away and in the food business. And so we set up housekeeping in an apartment, and one day the boss sent him to Chicago on a business trip. Well, 2 or 3 days later, the boss called me and said, we've got a terrible problem. I thought, uh-oh. He said, Tom has lost his credit cards. He's lost his wallet. He has no money. He's lost his return trip airfare back. And we're going to have an awful hard time getting him back from Chicago because he has no money now and no credit card, no way to get him a new ticket, and it's going to take several days. And I thought, oh, my God, I knew what this meant. I knew what it meant. This had been a pattern. He had spent years doing this kind of thing, losing everything, losing himself, losing days, losing where he was, and I knew what had happened. He had resumed drinking. When I met him at the airport, they finally got him back. He embraced me, and I felt the pint whiskey bottle in his hip pocket hit me right here, and I knew we were off and running again. Now, I knew it was my fault. After all, he'd remarried me, and wasn't he drinking again? It had to be my fault. So now the drinking became a real problem. Now he had a job, and he was good at what he did in that he showed up every day, killed himself to put in some orders, and then went out, and I understand, spent the day sitting at the end of the runway with his books and a bucket of ice, 7-Up, and a whiskey bottle, and spent the whole day out there, and then would check in at night. But he produced, and he brought them orders, and they put up with it. Every night he would come home, and he'd fall down in front of me, and I'd sit there and look down at the floor, and there he would lie, unconscious. So now this was absolutely the worst it had ever been. I hid out now. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't want to see anybody. And I certainly didn't want my mother to know it. I didn't want the children to know it. And I didn't draw the drapes, and I didn't get dressed sometimes for days. Didn't brush my teeth, didn't comb my hair. Just sat there and thought, my God, what am I going to do? He left one day. We had a terrible fight. And he said, I never want to see you again. And I thought, probably that's the best thing. That afternoon, they called me from another alcoholism treatment hospital and said, your husband just turned himself in down here. And I thought, well, how strange. I didn't tell him to go down there. Well, this was the turning point. He went to that hospital, and the whole thing was different now. He went because he wanted to go. He went because God intervened in his life. And they said to me, why don't you come down? We'd like to talk to you. And, of course, I didn't know what had happened. And I thought, I know what they want. They want me to sign a paper saying it's all my fault. Now, where I got that idea, I have no idea, but anyway. I thought, well, if that's what it takes, I'll go do that, and I'll go sign the paper, and if that's what it means, it's totally humiliating myself, I will do it. And I got down there, and they said, why don't you go to Al-Anon? And I said, well, I heard about Al-Anon last week, and somebody told me it's a place where the women go and sit across the hall and wait for alcoholics to get out of their meetings, and they just sit and wait there, and when they're all done, they all go out and have a hot fudge sundae. They said, no, 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 that's not what Al-Anon is. Why don't you go and find out? So I had my youngest daughter living with me at that time. She was 17, and I couldn't go that first night. I had to appear at my mother's and make up some big lie about where Tom was. But anyway, she said, Mother, I'll go, and I'll find out what the Al-Anon meeting's all about. I said, okay, fine. So I was sitting there waiting for her when she came home, and she walked in, and I said, what'd you find out? And she threw some literature down in front of me and said, I found out three things. You're psychotic, you're neurotic, and you're a martyr. Now, I thought this girl adored me. She did, and she does. But anyway, the interesting part about this is I have spent a good many years studying our Al-Anon materials. And, in fact, I was on the literature committee at the World Service Office for some time and worked at it. Information Center and read all of our materials, and I've read it and reread it, and not one place does it say we are psychotic, neurotic, or a martyr. Now, the martyr, yes, the psychotic, no, and sometimes a little neurotic, but the whole combination is nowhere in there. But I will allow them to use that if they ever want my permission, if they think it's valuable. So I was determined I'm going to go anyway. Now, I've got my backbone up, and whatever it takes, I'm going to go to this meeting, and if they're going to land on me, maybe that's what I deserve. So I got myself, it was 115 degrees in Phoenix. It was the sixth day of August. And I thought, well, I'll go, and I'll find out where this meeting is. And, of course, it's always way back in the back, down a long, dark place, and down in the back in the rear, and then there's one little bulb sticking out over the door. And you finally find your way back down there, and I had pressed up a black dress, if you can believe, 115 degrees, and I had some great big hideous white earrings. I thought, I'll hide behind these earrings, and I'll sneak in there, and they won't know I'm even there. And I'll case this thing out and find out how bad it's going to be. So anyway, I found the place way back down, and I heard this laughter, and I was so disgusted. I thought, what's the matter with these people? Don't they realize this is a terrible, terrible tragedy? And they're in there laughing. I don't know if I can stand this to go in there and hear this laughter or not. I was really incensed about it. So I go marching in there, and I'll just sit in the back row, and they won't know I'm there, and if I don't like it, I'll just get up and leave. Well, of course, they didn't. There was no back row. They saw me come in, and for some reason, they knew I was new. I said they must have sensed it. I mean, there was something about this whole thing that they must have just made a wild guess that I was a new person. Anyway, I went in, and they had a circle, and they drew me right up into the circle, and I couldn't speak. I sat there and put my head down, and the only word I could utter was, "My name is Mary Fran." Now, those people were absolutely wonderful to me, and I never, ever want to forget that. And when I relive it and rethink it, it still sends goosebumps up and down my spine, because here was a group of people that had never seen me before. They didn't care where I came from. They knew I was in terrible trouble. And they wanted to help me, and I knew that. And I said I never felt so wanted or needed in my life as when I walked into that meeting and sat down with those people. Every one of them said something very kind and loving to me, and I knew they wanted to help me. So I even thought they did a very special thing. They even held my hand and kind of squeezed it a little bit when we said the Lord's Prayer, and I was so moved. So I found a place where I was comfortable at last, and now I went every single night. And I went probably for 385 straight Al-Anon meetings. And I only tell you that not in a bragging way, but to tell you how much I loved it and how much I absorbed it and what it meant to me. And the first time I missed a meeting, I felt I'd lost half of my life. I had to miss one meeting. But anyway, I continued to go. And I loved what I heard. I loved the people in those rooms, and it meant so much to me. I don't identify with people that say they didn't like their first Al-Anon meeting. I don't understand that, but anyway, it did not affect me that way. I was so moved and thrilled to have found a place where I felt good. So I went all the time now, and I began to analyze it now. I thought, I wonder what these people want from me. They didn't say anything. They just offered to give me and give me and give me what they had. They didn't give me enough, though, and I used to think, if I had more money to put in the basket, maybe I'd get more out of the meetings. I could only afford a dollar and sometimes 50 cents, and I thought maybe if I put in $2, I'd get more out of it. I mean, I had the strangest thinking. I mean, I still have strange thinking, but I still analyze strings in a strange way. And I think, I wonder when the shoe's going to drop. I wonder what they really want of me. I wonder if they're brainwashing me here. And then I'd go to these meetings, and I'd see these little slogans around on the walls. And I thought, those must be left from some Sunday school class. I mean, the most infantile, stupid, unfinished sentences I ever heard. And then I'd say to people, well, would you tell me so-and-so and such-and-such? They'd say, well, just keep coming back. And I'd say, no, I want you to tell me now. You seem to be happy. You seem to be well-adjusted. Would you please explain to me what you do in a situation like so-and-so? And they'd say, we can't tell you that. I said, what do you mean you can't tell me that? Well, you just have to keep coming, and you'll hear it, and when it's time for you to understand it, you will. And I said, no. I mean, don't sit there with a smug look on your face. I want to know right now, when Tom does so-and-so, what should I do? Well, we can't tell you that. Well, I would be furious about it. You know, I'd go out of there just muttering, and why won't these people? I mean, they've got it all together. Why won't they tell me? What's the big secret here? And I had a terrible time with this, see, and I'm still analyzing and trying to understand all this. Then I would say constantly, why does Tom act the way he does? Why are my children so hateful? Why this? They say, why don't you just throw why out of your vocabulary? I'd say, oh, well, okay, I can do that. But how do I get the program? Now, how do you work the steps? How do you get serenity? They'd say, you've got to just keep coming back. I said, I do that, but you won't give me these answers. And I thought, what kind of a secret organization is this where they won't tell me what I want to hear? Well, anyway, eventually I began to understand. And, of course, through the seat of my pants, I eventually began to understand a lot of things, and I began to start working on the steps. Now, one day a friend of mine called, and she said, Mary Fran, I wonder if you'd announce at our home group tonight that I can no longer serve as a group representative. And I said, oh, okay. She said, I'm changing my hours, and I will no longer be able to go to the home group, so would you announce that? I thought, okay, I'll do that. So I went to the meeting, and I explained that Ruth could no longer be group representative. They said, oh, well, why don't you do it? And I said, well, what is it? They said, oh, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. So I thought, well, you know, I'm beginning to kind of get this, and it seems okay, and I should probably trust them. And so I said, well, okay, whatever it is, I'll do it. So I found myself at my first assembly meeting. Now, assembly meetings are very interesting. And I was enthralled by this. I mean, my group was trusting me to vote for them, and they had some big issues. Boy, they had all kinds of wild electric flying in the air, and we were electing officers. So the group was trusting me. We were doing it by secret ballot. They had a chalkboard up here, and they had all these group representatives sitting down there, and I was sitting about halfway back right on the aisle, and I thought this was exciting and wonderful, and they elected a delegate. I didn't know who she was, but I thought it was great. And an alternate delegate and an area chairman, and I'd seen these people around. They seemed to be okay. And so anyway, I thought, this is really exciting, you know, and here I was a part of all this excitement. And so then they said, "Nan, we'll need an area secretary," and nothing. So they said, "Well, you know, I'm sure some of you people out there would consider making yourselves available." Now, in Arizona, we didn't always have enough DRs to run for area officers. So they said, "In this case, we'll open it up to the group representatives, and we do need an area secretary." So I was sitting there, "Oh, isn't this fun, you know, and all that's going on?" And so they said, "Would anybody care to make themselves available?" The big silence. Now, there weren't big long lines queuing up to be an area secretary, and I didn't know why, but I thought, well, somebody will probably do it, and I'm new here, and so... They said, "Well, we'll give you another minute to think about it." Still no response. So they said, "Well, we'll just go down the aisle. We'll go down and ask each group representative in turn, and would you, no, would you, no, would you, no?" And so they went on down and on down. "No, no, 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 no." And they got down to me, and I said, "No." And just at that exact moment, from a 40-foot ceiling came a crashing down a 2,000-pound chandelier, hit in the aisle, brushed my shoulder, sparks and flames flying out, and I said, "I will, I will." Now, you talk about your spiritual awakening. I became the area secretary. It was fabulous. And you know, this is probably one of the better things I've ever done for myself in my life. Myself, I did it for myself, you bet. You know, to this day, I never go into a room that I don't check to see where the chandeliers are. Anyway, I loaded into the car with the other area officers, and we went everywhere in Arizona. I had the best time I had had in years. I began to feel very good about myself. I started getting outside of my problems. My self-confidence was coming back. I redeveloped my sense of humor, and we just had an absolutely wonderful time. And Tom would wave goodbye. We'd back out of the driveway. "You have good time, girls. Enjoy yourself." And away we'd go all over the state of Arizona. We took the message of Al-Anon to big cities, little hamlets, little villages, big towns, little towns, and just had an absolutely wonderful time and some of the best memories I have in this program are the days of spending in automobiles driving across deserts, mountains, rivers, wherever to carry the message of Al-Anon, and it changed my life. When I got into service, it started to change my life. It made such a difference, it's unbelievable to me. I'd never done anything strictly out of just wanting to give in my life without looking for something in return. This had changed everything. Well, I did that, and there was a time then when a man approached me one day and said, "Mary Fran, would you and your husband come down to this rehab house and speak to some women alcoholics, their recovery, and share your program with them?" I said, "Oh, no, 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 I don't talk. No, I don't do that." Now, my husband was a salesman, a professional man. He had been putting on sales seminars all his life. He loved to do it. He had a wonderful personality, spoke easily to everybody. But no, no, I don't do that. They said, "Well, if Tom would just come down and maybe share some of his AA experiences with these ladies, and maybe you could just come along and say, 'And I go to Al-Anon, it helps me a lot.'" I said, "Oh, well, I could probably do that. I could say, 'I go to Al-Anon, it helped me a lot.' I could do that." They said, "Wonderful. I know the ladies would appreciate your coming down, and if you just accompany Tom and let him share his experiences, and you just, you know, just throw that in, it'd be fine." I said, "Oh, yeah, okay." So on the appointed day, we went down, and as we drove up to this great big old house in kind of a lower part of Phoenix down there in kind of a funny neighborhood, there were a lot of cars there, and I said, "Oh, somebody must be having a block party." We entered into this big old house that was, as I say, made into a rehab house for recovering women alcoholics. We walked in there, and my God, here was this room set up in theater style. A podium up here with a microphone. I took one look at that, and I started to come apart. Tom said, "What in the world is wrong with you? You're white as a sheet." This guy bustled up to me. "Oh, Mary Fran, you and Tom are here. Oh, how nice. You both share your program. Would you like to be first or second?" I said, "First or second? I don't even want to be here. What do you mean, first or second?" "Well, you could just come up there and tell us a little bit about your Al-Anon life." I said, oh, my God, I can't do that. I cannot speak. I told you, I don't. Oh, you'll be just fine. You'll be fine. He took me by the elbow and rushed me right up here to the podium. I was totally unprepared. I was absolutely paralyzed with fear, and I know what that means to be paralyzed with fear. I hadn't even thought about giving a talk. I never would have given a talk. The microphone terrified me. To stand up in front of a podium in front of people was just absolutely the most terrible thing that ever could have happened to me. And I stood up here, and all of a sudden I said, my name is Mary Fran, and I went to the ceiling and was up in the far corner of this room. I was on the ceiling. Now, I didn't tell this for a long time, because I think people think I'm pretty flaky anyway, and I thought, if I tell that story, they're going to think, boy, she's really gone over the bend or around the whatever. And I didn't tell it for a long time, but now I do tell that, and it's surprising how many places I go, and I'll hear somebody go, as if the same thing has happened to them, and it does happen to people. Anyway, I was up there sitting or standing or lying or whatever in the corner of the room, in the back of the room. I was looking down at the people, and it was very quiet and very peaceful. And I heard this woman's voice droning on and on and on. And I thought, I wonder why that woman doesn't stop. She's got this terrible Midwestern nasal twang. And it's just awful. If she'd just be quiet, I'd be very comfortable up here. But I looked out at the people, and it was very pleasant up there. It was kind of cozy and warm and intimate. Pretty soon, I was back down here, and I heard myself say, and thank you very much, and I stepped away from the microphone. After it was over, a gentleman came up to me and said, I wish my wife had been here tonight to hear what you had to say. And I said, I wish I had been here tonight to hear what I had to say. But I have had some very exciting things happen to me as a result of this program. And I tried at that point then to make an effort. I thought, it's getting in my way that I am so afraid of speaking. And I did try to now accept an invitation to speak when I was invited. And it wasn't easy in the beginning, but you know that I believe that God helped me with that. They say there's a scientific explanation for such an out-of-the-body experience, that a person is so triggered with fear that it is a function to get out of your body, to get away from that experience. But I believe God did that for me. I believe he looked at me and said, boy, this old broad's got herself into another one. I'm going to have to help her out. And I never step to a microphone without saying, God, I'm going to need a little help with this again. And I always get it. So I like to share that with people because innately, I think many of us are afraid to get up and speak, afraid of exposing ourselves as we really are, or afraid of the microphone, or for what other purpose or reason we are afraid to do it. And I have tried to force myself to do it repeatedly until now. I am doing it with very little fear and trepidation. And I always ask for help, and I always get it. I was the delegate for Arizona, and I was kind of forced into that, and I was telling somebody tonight, I never had a job in Al-Anon that I wanted. I never had one I sought, and I never had the intelligence to appreciate what it did for me until after it was over. I did put my name in for regional trustee. That's the one thing I ever did, and I only did that because I thought, if I don't do that, I may regret it all my life, that I could have maybe offered myself there, and whatever would come out of it, I would have felt badly if I hadn't at least done that. I don't know why I was elected a regional trustee. There were many people that had much more experience, much more ability, writing skills, speaking skills, much more time in Al-Anon, much more education. And why I was elected, I don't know. I finally decided that I needed the extra growth that went with that job. I think God felt that I had a long ways to go to develop myself, and I feel that I have developed myself as a result of that. I have met people all over the world. I have met thousands of people. I have thousands of friends in Al-Anon today, and I really, really appreciate that. I had not one friend when I came here. I have had a stupendous time going places and meeting people and sharing this program, and I do believe it is God-given. And I do never stop thanking those people that have made it possible for me to find this place. So So I always like to close by thanking the committee for inviting me here. It's been a lovely, lovely experience, as always, to come to Northern California. And I do like to give a small tribute to Tom, who without his rambunctious, boyish charm, I never would have found this program. And most of all, I'd like to thank God for making it possible for us all to be together again this weekend. Thank you very much.